This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A little bit later in the hour, we'll get a preview of next week's Board of Education hearings in Kansas on how evolution might be taught in their schools. But first, much of the biomedical research done in this country is funded by the federal government. Not so for research with human embryonic stem cells, because they're derived from embryos. President Bush decreed in 2001 that you could use the research if you wanted to support from the U.S. government. A few embryonic stem cell lines, those already in existence at the time the policy was set in 2001, are exempt from that rule, but many scientists say most of these are useless. Frozen out by the federal government, some institutions and states, led by California and now others like New Jersey and Massachusetts, are creating their own stem cell laboratories, financed by state or private money. Now, normally the federal government would help guide research by creating a set of ethical rules that researchers would follow. If the feds finance the research, the feds can regulate it. But here, no money, no regulation. A report out this week from the National Academies aims to fill that void. It offers U.S. scientists a set of ethical rules to follow in deriving, storing, and working with human embryonic stem cells. This hour, we're going to talk about these new rules, what's happening in the states, and we'll check in on where the research stands. So it's, as I say, it's an embryonic research, stem cell research update. And if you'd like to get in on our conversation, our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And as always, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Please let me introduce my guest. Richard Hines is the co-chair of the National Academies Committee on Guidelines for Human Embryonic Stem Cell Research. He's also an investigator with the Howard Hughes Medical Institute and the Daniel K. Ludwig Professor of Cancer Research at MIT. He joins us today from the studios of member station WBUR in Boston. Welcome to the program, Dr. Hines.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
You're welcome. Irving Weissman, MD, is the director of the Institute for Cancer and Stem Biology and Medicine and the Virginia and D.K. Ludwig Professor for Clinical Investigation in Cancer Research at Stanford School of Medicine in Stanford, California. He joins me today from the campus there. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Weissman.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Dr. Hines, let me ask you first, right now, what kind of federal oversight is there on research with human embryonic stem cells? Is there any?
There's a little, yes. Yeah. There's oversight by the federal government of the research that they fund with the limited number of cell lines that you mentioned earlier.
Right.
They have some guidelines that constrain what people can do with those. Mm-hmm. In addition, there's a great deal of regulation of biomedical research in general. And although it wasn't written or designed to deal with embryonic stem cells, some of it constrains some of the things that one can do, use of human subjects, use of animals. Mm-hmm. But there's no general federal oversight of embryonic stem cell research as such.
So it's sort of a patchwork wherever it happens.
It's very definitely a patchwork.
Yeah. Dr. Weissman, your institute at Stanford does stem cell research. Does it have its own set of rules that apply only to research done there?
Well, we have, in anticipation of the call for grants from the California Institute of Regenerative Medicine, which came from Prop 71, we set up several committees, including a bioethics committee headed by David Magnus, one of our bioethicists, and including Hank Greeley, who was the head of the panel that advised the California state on these issues, and others. And so we have established how we're going to go forward, but we waited until these guidelines came out, and I'm certainly glad that we did.
Yeah, well, let's get into them. Dr. Hines, give us some of the main points of what the National Academies Committee is proposing for guidelines.
Well, first of all, it sets up a mechanism for oversight and recommends that every institution conducting any research along these lines establish an oversight committee to review all of that research and make sure that it's conducted appropriately and decide which things are allowed and which things are not. Those are institutional panels specifically designed to oversee stem cell research, and they're similar to panels that already exist at institutions to cover human subjects research and animal research. They're formulated according to the same general principles. In addition, we recommend that there be established a national forum, national panel to oversee the issues in general on a continuing basis. This research is moving fairly fast, and things change, and it's not possible to anticipate at this point everything that might come up. So we believe there should be a national panel to periodically review the guidelines and deal with new issues and act as a forum for public input and ethical input as well as scientific input.
Mm-hmm.
That's, I think, the most important thing, that we've set up a mechanism for oversight, and we've designed a set of guidelines to make sure that everything is done ethically, in particular that the acquisition of materials to make stem cell lines are overseen very carefully to make sure that everybody, the donors, have given consent for everything, that their privacy is protected. That seems a very important aspect. And we have tightened up some of the loopholes that exist in the existing regulations, which, as you said before, are a patchwork. And we also lay down some rules about which aspects of stem cell research, once the cell lines have been made, which aspects need more careful review. And in a few situations, things we recommend should not be done.
Such as?
Such as we reiterate the established position of the National Academies that reproductive cloning should not be done at this time. We reiterate the well-established guideline that no human embryos, should be cultured for more than 14 days. Neither of those are new. They're both significant, and we repeated them. We also mentioned a couple of things about animal-human chimeras, which should not be done. It will be necessary to conduct experiments in which embryonic stem cells or their derivatives are inserted into animals. That will be necessary for preclinical testing. It'll be required by the FDA. However, when one puts embryonic stem cells or neural stem cells into an animal, there are a few things one needs to be concerned about, at least as a prospect, and we ruled out a couple of general categories of things that we thought should not be done at this time until we know more.
And one of those was brain chemistry,
Well, one of those was not to put anything into a primate embryo, primate blastocyst, any human embryonic stem cells. And the second one was not to allow any of the chimeras to breed. We did not rule out brain chimeras. We did not. We put them in a category that needed extra review and ongoing oversight by the committees, which we call escrow committees, by the way. By the escrow committees, mm-hmm. We recommended that those sorts of experiments should be thought about very carefully, done in a staged way, preferably with some prior experiments using animal cells, in order to find out whether there is indeed a problem or not. There may not be.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Wiseman, do you think there's any places that it should not be done besides the ones we've mentioned here?
I think that they've covered the areas completely where you shouldn't do it. I had been worried from the beginning about the theoretical problem of having them in a blastocyst that could make gametes. I know it's mainly theoretical, but it's still one that we have to pay attention to.
And as far as research with, for example, maybe putting humans into animal brains, things like that?
Yeah, that's, they've covered it very completely. Yeah. There are many things you cannot do anyway but to put the cells into, for example, mouse brains, immunodeficient mouse brains. That's been done many times in the past and will continue. The particular issue that Richard just brought up of putting cells into non-human primate brains, now not neural stem cells are their derivatives, is an important issue to consider, largely because of the closeness between those two species, we and non-human primates. But on the other hand, anybody who's going to do a clinical trial with these kinds of neural stem cells need to pass safety tests. And the safety tests are required by the FDA to go through the non-human primate brain, so there will be necessarily those kinds of preclinical tests, and I assume of very limited duration.
Dr. Hines, are there any guidelines and restrictions of where, what lines the stem cells can come from, as there were when President Bush made his 4 years ago?
There are restrictions about informed consent and privacy protections of the donors at the time of acquisition of the materials. Other than that, no. But if anybody who was donating any of these materials were to say no, then that would be respected. They should be asked, and given the opportunity to agree to donate or refuse to donate, with no consequence whatever for any treatment that they may be receiving. So it's our recommendations are on process, not on specific location and not on specific timing. Mm-hmm. We have tightened up those rules, actually, the informed consent rules that we propose and the prohibition against reimbursement beyond expenses, payment, in other words, for donation of materials. Those are tighter than some of the existing regulations.
So if you wanted to use embryos that of course, are the product of a male and a female, you'd have to get both the sperm donor, if there was one, and the woman, both their permissions.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. How much do you think, and I'll ask both of you, let me ask Irv Wiseman first, how much do you think this will help expand the scope of stem cell research in the U.S.?
I think it'll be dramatic. I think that now everybody at small and large academic or not-for-profit institutions will be looking at these guidelines and saying, okay, now I know how to proceed. And using these, you know, as essentially a menu, we will all be able to move into this arena and know that we are on solid ground. It is heartbreaking to me that our national government cannot provide these kinds of guidelines because of their political considerations. We should have followed the Recombinant Advisory Commission example and precedent so that all NIH-funded grants were regulated by the NIH, all commercial aspects of recombinant DNA were regulated by the FDA. That's where these things should be. Mm-hmm. They should be national, and it's heartbreaking that it isn't.
All right, we'll get more into that issue. We have to take a break. We'll come back and talk lots more about stem cell research with my guests, Richard Hines and Irving Wiseman. Your questions, stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about stem cell research and policy. With stem cell research now growing rapidly in other countries and states financing their own work to get around these restrictions, there appears to be a reevaluation in Washington about increasing the number of stem cell lines eligible for federal funding. And some lawmakers appear to have found their voice. The Stem Cell Research Enhancement Act of 2005 has been introduced in both the House and the Senate, and that bill would relax restrictions on federal funding for research with the embryonic stem cells. Joining us now to talk about the House bill is one of its co-sponsors. Diana DeGette is a representative from Colorado's 1st District in Denver and the Democratic Chief Deputy Whip. She joins us today from Denver. Welcome to the program, Congresswoman.
Ira, great being with you today.
Thank you. Tell us about this bill. How much would it widen federal support for human embryonic stem cell research?
What the bill does is it expands the national policy to include all embryos which are created as a result of in vitro fertilization techniques and which are scheduled to be discarded. And it also puts a strict ethical control on that research, very similar to what the National Academy of Sciences recommendations that just came out are.
Mm-hmm. So there would be, you could turn the clock back any time to harvest these stem cells that were going to be thrown away anyhow?
Right. I mean, basically what our bill does is it reverses the president's executive order. Since he entered that order on August 11th, 2001, what we've learned is there are many fewer stem cell lines available than the administration believed. We've also learned that those cells are grown on mouse feeder cells, so they're not going to be effective in the future. What you've seen as a result of the president's policy, which the administration admits is a political policy, not a scientific policy, you've seen research going overseas. You've seen it going to private institutions that are not using any federal money to do it. And you're seeing results like the California Initiative. So I think it's what's developing is sort of a Wild West mentality. as respects stem cell research. We really need to get back in control of it. We need to get the ethical guidelines. We also need to put the engine of the NIH behind this cutting-edge research.
In fact, the head of the NIH, Dr. Zerhouni, sort of has softened his position on this, has he not?
Yes, I spend quite a bit of time talking to Dr. Zerhouni about this, and of course, he's the chief spokesman for the administration's scientific policies. But even Dr. Zerhouni and his senior, the heads of his institutes, are now admitting that the cell lines that we have are inadequate and that there's insufficient ethical control over the research that's going on. So they have been softening their stance as well.
Are you finding support from both parties, or is it divided? Is it going to be divided along party lines? You're getting bi-party support on this.
No, as a Democrat, the one thing I've learned in my 8 years in Congress, if you don't have Republican support, you never pass a bill. And this bill, it's great to work on. We have bipartisan support in both the House and the Senate. Mike Castle from Delaware is my Republican co-sponsor in the House. And Orrin Hatch is an ally of ours in the Senate. So it really crosses party lines. It also crosses the lines between pro-life and pro-choice.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Are we going to get a vote on this soon, do you think?
Well, we have now almost 200 co-sponsors of the bill. And privately, we've been whipping very hard in the House. We believe we have close to 218 votes in the House. In the Senate, they've got well over a majority who have signed letters and co-sponsored the bill. And the House leadership has told my Republican allies that they're expecting a vote before the July 4th recess. So there's a lot going on, and we think we'll have a vote before the summer recess.
Because there's talk that there's a drain going overseas here, that the U.S. is, as you say, is losing out on this research.
A lot of people are really concerned about the brain drain, both going overseas and also going to California. My research institution, the University of Colorado, they're concerned they're going to lose some of their most promising researchers because the California Initiative is so well-funded. So there's a great concern about brain drain.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thank you for taking time to talk with us.
It's great being on.
And good luck to you.
Thanks.
We're talking this hour with Diana DeGette, who is a representative from Colorado's 1st District in Denver and Democratic Chief Deputy Whip. We're talking about stem cell research, the state of stem cell research and human embryonic stem cells this hour on Talk of the Nation. And we're talking with my guest, Richard Hines, co-chair of the National Academy's Committee on Guidelines for Human Embryonic Stem Cell Research, Irving Weissman, director of the Institute for Cancer and Stem Cell Biology and Medicine at Stanford University School of Medicine. He's a clinical professor for clinical investigation there. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Dr. Weissman, what do you think of that bill? Sounds hopeful to you?
It sounds very hopeful. It's an important step. It's especially important that it's going on in the House of Representatives, which passed the Weldon bill two or three times without hearings in committees. So this is a chance now to get the scientific and medical information out in the House, as it has been out in the Senate now for several years.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. What do you think, Dr. Hines? You're looking forward to that?
I think it would be great if that bill were to pass, because NIH is the primary source of funding and leadership of research in the country, and it would open up support to a much wider range of people to do many of the experiments that need to be done.
Let's go to the phones. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt.
The relaxation of the rules that Congresswoman DeGette mentioned doesn't go quite as wide as the guidelines that we propose, so it wouldn't allow everybody to do everything, but it would allow them to do a great deal. That would be a great step forward.
Could I say something to that?
Sure.
I think it's very important. The kinds of bill that Senator Hatch and Feinstein and the others in the Senate have backed goes a little bit further as well. And it goes to the point of producing new human pluripotent stem cell lines, starting with the genetic information of people with genetic diseases, taking their adult cells and transferring that genetic information into an egg to make a pluripotent stem cell line. None of the cell lines that sit in in vitro fertilization clinics have those diseases. There's no Lou Gehrig's disease. There's no Alzheimer's disease. There's no juvenile diabetes, and on, all diseases that are largely determined by the genetics that you inherit. So it's really critical for those of us like me who are physicians and MDs and take an oath to try to understand and treat human disease that we can go the next step and really move this fast. Now, there's lots and lots of research that has to be done before that could go forward, but it's important for people to know, the public to know, that our main intent with this research is not to create monsters or go beyond guidelines or whatever you see in the current films, but our main intent is to try to understand and treat human diseases. And so I usually tell people, let's have this list of diseases. Now, which of these do you think we don't need to understand, and which of these don't need therapies?
Mm-hmm. But do you think that the parts of that Senate bill that have the better stuff that you'd like will make it through a compromise here someplace along the line when they get the two bills together?
It's made it through in California.
Yeah.
It's made it through in New Jersey. I believe it will make its way in states because of course, the states' rights issues. I hope it can make its way in the Senate. Who can predict what's going to happen?
We keep hearing little news snippets about the fact that some, not embryonic stem cells, but adult stem cells are being able to be transformed back so early into the stages that they were akin to human embryonic stem cells, and saying, hey, people are saying, hey, see, we don't need these embryonic stem cells anymore.
Yeah, that's without any scientific basis. I'm an adult stem cell biologist. My lab and our labs have isolated each of the adult stem cells so far. When we put those other experiments, some of them published, to the test, they either can't be replicated or they can be explained by very rare cells that fuse and therefore fool the initial investigators. But let me be absolutely unequivocal. Adult blood-forming stem cells are wonderful for treatment of patients who need blood regeneration. They don't do anything for regenerating heart or brain or skeletal muscle or liver. Adult brain-forming stem cells in their preclinical tests are wonderful for regenerating parts of the brain are lost or protecting part of the brains that are lost. They do not turn into anything but brain cells. So anybody who is stating, as many people have stated, that we now have replicated experiments that show that there is ready transdifferentiation, that's what it's called, of one stem cell type to another, one adult stem cell type to another, or differentiation to a more pluripotent early stage simply is not telling you something from replicated scientific experiments.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Yes, Dr. Hines, did you want to jump in?
I would agree completely. That doesn't mean one shouldn't work on both adult and embryonic.
Right.
They have their merits, both of them, but the adult ones are not sufficient.
Mm-hmm. Stan in Cleveland, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Hi, go ahead.
Just a question for the, about the bioethics of the issue. It's interesting you're talking about the animal-human kind of the different, possible uses for the embryonic stem cells. And it came about culturing a human embryo for no longer than 14 days. And what are the ethical roots of deciding that a, 12-day embryo doesn't deserve the same consideration as a 15-day embryo? And a sharp bright line at that point, why can't you draw it later on and say, well, basically you can include any, at any point up until what would be considered abortion. So,
Dr. Hines, how do you draw that line?
That's a good question. The reason the line was drawn there, and it was drawn there some years ago, nearly 20 years ago, I believe, bearing on the culture of human embryos in the context of IVF. The reason for drawing the line at 14 days, or the primitive streak, which occurs at that time, is that that's the stage at which the embryo ceases to be an undistinguished ball of cells and becomes something that's beginning to have a front and a back, and the very early beginnings of the formation of a nervous system. So it was felt that at that point, it's beginning to take form, whereas prior to that, it's really an undistinguished, undifferentiated ball of cells. That was the reason for the distinction. It seems a fairly clear one, and people have signed on to that line for that reason over, as I said, many years.
I've spoken with many people who, you know, over these issues, people ask me these questions. I actually was at a conference recently where people in the audience, it was being discussed, and they were shocked to learn that they thought human embryonic stem cells were being harvested from almost fetuses ready to be born. You know, they couldn't believe that we're talking about this little blastocyte here. And
we're talking about a bowl of cells with only around 200 cells. And for a non-expert, it's hard to tell a human embryo from a sea urchin embryo at that stage.
There's been so much propaganda about this, political
posturing. When I was head of a precursor panel of the National Academies, we did an experiment, and then I kept doing it, to ask people, even biological scientists who weren't in this field, to draw an embryo. And almost every one of them drew a fetus. So we recognized right away that the language that we use does not really mean the same to people outside of this developmental biology field and inside the field.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking about stem cell research this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. And we're talking with Richard Hines and Irving Wiseman as our number. Let's see if we can get another phone call or two. Kyle in Indiana, hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Yes, hello. My question is, with these new ethical guidelines, what sort of teeth is behind them? Is it if people decide not to follow the guidelines? Is it exclusively a withdrawal of funding? And if it is, how is it so much different from the federal government's regulation saying that they won't fund such research?
Withdrawal of funding is certainly part of the sanction and pressures for compliance. We spell out several mechanisms for ensuring compliance in the report. We state that the review panels, the escrow committees and the IRBs, should review compliance at the time of approval of a project, that the funding agency should review it at the time of providing funds. That would be either the federal funding agencies or the non-federal ones. And we stress that journals should also enforce it. Now, scientists are in the business to raise money to do their research, get it done, and publish it. That's how they make their reputations. And if one withdraws those rewards for the research, they won't make anything of it, and they won't do it. And those sorts of pressures are the ones that we are subject to for human subjects research and for animal research, and they work very well for ensuring compliance.
Should Congress pass this bill and open up the lines of research, are states going to be, you know, states that are now collecting a lot of money, California, other states, Massachusetts, New Jersey, other states like that, are they going to be against something like this, thinking they're going to lose business?
I wouldn't think so.
Yeah, I don't think so. And we should say, as we said before, that it's unlikely that the Hatch-Feinstein bill in the Senate, which also permits and regulates this nuclear transfer research, will be passed. It's not included in the House bill, as far as I can tell. And so there is a need for states to continue to do that research regulated. And actually, I hope that the California Institute of Regenerative Medicine, which is funded through Prop 71, adopts these guidelines, and that will give force to keeping within such guidelines.
Have we seen a drain yet to California? Are scientists picking up and moving yet?
Well, we don't have the funding in our hands yet, but I promise you we're trying.
Yes, he is trying, and we're resisting. So.
Yes.
So there is this state-to-state healthy competition going on here.
Yes.
Could I add something about state-to-state? One of the big benefits of having a uniform set of guidelines like this is that it makes collaboration among scientists and the sharing of cell lines among scientists much more feasible than it would be with a patchwork of regulations. And collaboration and sharing of reagents are essential to a good conduct of science.
All right. That's the last word. We'll be watching this very carefully. I'd like to thank you both, Richard Hines, co-chair of the National Academies Committee on Guidelines for Human Embryonic Stem Cell Research and the Daniel K. Ludwig Professor of Cancer Research at MIT, Irving Weissman, Director of the Institute for Cancer and Stem Biology and Medicine, and the Virginia D.K. Ludwig Professor for Clinical Investigation and Cancer Research at Stanford and Stanford School of Medicine. Welcome. Thank you for joining us this hour, and good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
We're going to take a quick break and talk about something that keeps coming back into the news, the teaching of evolution in high schools, the continuing debate in Kansas. Kansas is going to be center stage next week, and scientists are going to try an unusual tactic they've never tried before. We'll talk about it when we get back, so stay with us.